At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Hello and welcome back to Behind the Knife. I hope everybody's post-ab site recovery is going well. I'm Michael Vu and with me is Kevin Kinnery. Before I begin, let me just say that we have been slammed, in a good way, with emails from you listeners regarding our call for Behind the Knife collaborators. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, let me briefly explain. We are asking for applications for teams of three surgeons to become regular contributors to the podcast. You would apply to be a three-man team in charge of a specific surgical subspecialty, like trauma, surgical oncology, endocrine, etc. And you'd spend the next 2 years making one episode every 3 months for a total of 8 episodes. If you want to know more details on that, check out the 2021 kickoff episode, which was the last released episode, and also check out our post on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, what's today's episode? Today we are proud to release the first episode in a short series, Plastic Surgery for the General Surgeon. We're bringing you expert plastic surgeons who will share insights and expertise in plastic surgery topics relevant to the general surgeon. Today's topic is reconstruction of the trunk. It'll be a two-part episode. This first part will be about the perineum, and in part two, we'll discuss the chest and abdomen. If you like this plastic surgery series, stick around and keep listening, because we will have forthcoming episodes about burns and skin grafts, essentials of flap-based reconstruction, breast reconstruction, and more. And if you'd like a topic you'd like to recommend for this series, please leave us a tweet or email us. And thank you to all of our listeners for recommending this topic. So again, the topic for today is reconstruction of the trunk, and our guest expert is Dr. Shailesh Agarwal, Associate Surgeon in the Division of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at Brigham and Women's in Boston. Dr. Agarwal is a medical school graduate of the University of Chicago, after which he completed a plastic surgery residency at the University of Michigan, followed by a microsurgery fellowship back at U of C. Hey, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Agarwal, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Michael, Kevin, thank you for having me. This is awesome.
You know, I was flipping through some of my books back when I was a medical student. I did a lot of plastic surgery rotations as a medical student. And I just realized now my Michigan Manual of Plastic Surgery with Benjamin Levy on the cover. You're an author of a couple of the chapters in there.
Yeah. As residents, they did a really nice job of getting us involved in writing chapters for the book and kind of giving the resident perspective on things, which was nice.
That book got me through a lot of those rotations. I mean, it was invaluable. So thank you for your contribution.
Thanks. Yeah, you'd be surprised. I still have that book with me and still, you know, oftentimes we'll take a look at it real quickly, look at some diagrams and things.
Yeah. I remember carrying it in my medical student lab coat, which was tough because it was already stuffed with dressings for morning rounds. So before we begin, can you tell us a little bit about your current practice at the Brigham?
Sure. So I started here about a year ago, and so my practice is microvascular reconstruction of the breast, as well as general reconstruction of the lower extremity and trunk. I would say that breast reconstruction is probably about 50 to 60% of my practice, which is nice, you know, starting out, especially to be able to have an area where I'm really focused in doing a lot of that reconstruction. And slowly, as I've gotten to know more surgeons in the Brigham community, my opportunity to kind of perform reconstruction outside the breast and chest wall area has grown to include abdominal wall or extremity as well. So it continues to grow and evolve.
How about your research program? You're pretty prolific based on my cursory search.
Yeah, so I basically I started a lab here when I came in. And obviously, things have been a bit, slow to start with COVID. But actually, my laboratory is focused on studying lymphedema and really studying kind of cellular molecular mechanisms of lymphedema. And in addition, I've kind of now become very interested in this idea, this concept of biosensor enabled gene therapies. So I'm basically developing, therapeutics that are peptide-based therapies that are expressed and activated during certain environmental cues. And I'm using lymphedema as kind of a starting ground to kind of develop that technology.
Oof, lymphedema. We'll have to have you on the podcast another time later to talk about that. That's a whole other topic.
I'd be happy to.
Okay. So for our discussion today, I know that the topic trunk reconstruction is enormous. So our goal is to focus in on some classic plastic surgery problems that anyone might face. We'll be discussing the perineum, the abdominal wall, and the chest. Let's start with the perineum and periperineal wounds. So sure. When I think about perineal defects that need reconstruction, there are a lot of potential causes that run through my mind. But one of the causes that sticks out most to me, just because those wounds end up being so gnarly, are Fournier gangrene defects. You know, the extent of debridement can be so much.
Sure.
What are the other common etiologies for perineal defects that you've come across, Dr. Agarwal?
So in addition to Fournier gangrene, then, oftentimes it'll be tumor resection. So whether it's sarcoma or even colorectal with APRs, those are obviously more planned approaches, which is different from the Fournier gangrene patient who comes in and requires urgent or emergent debridements versus tumor, where you have more of a not elective but semi-elective approach to this, which is more collaborative, And then some alternatives would be like sacral pressure sores and things like that, which aren't strictly perineal, but are still in that general area and make use of similar types of soft tissues for reconstruction.
Okay. Well, let's present a case vignette then. Let's consider that we have a 50-year-old man who underwent an APR for a low rectal cancer. He's 2 weeks post-op, and the wound has just been kind of breaking down progressively. You know, every morning, the residents are reporting back that it's just looking kind of soupier and soupier, not very nice back there. The colorectal surgeon has returned to the OR several times to debride the wound and has most recently found that it's breaking down. This sounds like a common problem that I'm sure you've seen before, right?
Sure. You know, as plastic surgeons, certainly we see the ones that are developing into wounds. And so while we can speak to frequency, the fact is that many times it's going perfectly fine, you know, and so that's important for us to think about as plastic surgeons as well.
Mm-hmm. When have you found that you're getting called about APR and APR wounds? Are you frequently collaborating with the oncologic surgeon in advance? Does it depend? I'm sure it depends at least somewhat on what the expected resection size is going to be. What's your involvement like in these cases?
So it depends on the resection size, but it also depends on any history of perineal radiation as well, which may increase the likelihood of breakdown, of wound breakdown. And so the things, you know, that we want to be thinking about when we're thinking about kind of reconstructive approaches are you know, is there a history of radiation? What's the patient's nutritional status? And those two aspects are really guiding forces in deciding whether reconstruction is required. The fact is that, you know, as a plastic surgeon, we're getting involved after the general surgeon may decide that it's something that requires us to take a look at. Or, in the ideal circumstance, if there's a good relationship between the plastic surgeon and the colorectal surgeons, a long-standing relationship, then we may get in earlier. In which case, then we're thinking about if there's been a history of radiation, what can we do preventatively to reduce the likelihood of breakdown, and you know, really reduce the patient's stay in the hospital and get them back home.
Yeah, this is a very tough wound to close as a general surgeon, colorectal surgeon, and we've all kind of seen these wounds and definitely fear that. Do you have any thoughts or any tips in the patient that maybe doesn't have any particular risk factors, but just thoughts on how to get a successfully an APR wound successfully heal?
If you in the setting where there's no risk factors, and let's say there's not a plastic surgeon involved, then I think the things from my perspective are, so I'm a big believer in blood supply, right? So blood supply is what keeps tissue alive. It's what allows tissues to heal. We put in a lot of sutures. We like to put in a lot of sutures to keep things together. But the fact is that there is a trade-off. Sutures hold tissue together, but they're also ischemic by nature. And so there has to be, you know, an appreciation for a layered closure while at the same time minimizing ischemia to the tissue. And so that's always been my approach and my thought process. So the things that I'm really thinking about are, how do I reduce any type of drainage, pseudo-fistulization that may occur? And how do I improve the blood supply? So to reduce the drainage, I think drains are important. Drains are key. And I'm a big believer, anytime I'm doing a substantial reconstruction, you know, a couple of drains are not a big deal. Obviously, they're not a nidus for infection. And quite to the contrary, I think they help remove any type of fluid that would otherwise drain out because of gravity. And basically create an opening through an incision line. I think for ischemia, thinking about patient positioning after surgery is really important. So, you know, is the patient laying down or are they sitting versus having them side to side, right? And so those are the types of things that I think are really important postoperatively. And I think as far as intraoperatively with the closure, a layered closure is important. But a layered closure doesn't mean just grabbing fat and closing fat to fat, because one, fat doesn't hold anything. And two, ischemic fat just becomes necrotic fat and basically drains. So really grabbing just a little bit of, if there is like any type of scarpal fascia to bring in for a layer, dermis for a layer, and then a subcuticular closure or like horizontal mattresses, I think would be fine as well. I do like horizontal mattresses, although they're an ischemic stitch, because I think that the eversion that you get from horizontal mattress sutures really does help the healing process. And that's not unique to APR defects. I think that's, you know, across the body.
Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
What are your thoughts on negative pressure incisional therapy like Prevena? Is that something you're using in clinical practice?
Yeah, so absolutely. So a lot of my colleagues like to use incisional vacs over here. When I was in training, we didn't really use incisional vacs, and that could be biased based on where I trained, but that could also be biased based on timing of training, right? So it's possible that over time, incisional vacs have become more in vogue. I think it's reasonable to do. I don't think it's harmful. The fact is that if you put incisional vac on someone's APR defect that's been closed, they're less likely to probably lay down on it. They're probably less likely to put pressure on it because of the discomfort from having that on, and it probably gets rid of any type of drainage and kind of proactively pulls out any drainage and keeps the area relatively dry. So I think that those are, you know, that's another way of thinking about what the utility of that Prevena vac is. So I'm not opposed to it. I think, and I don't think it hurts. And it may help a little bit, which for challenging areas of reconstruction or closure, you know, it's not a bad idea to do things that aren't harmful, that would help, that have the potential to help.
So Kevin posited a patient with no risk factors. What are the sorts of risk factors that are going through your mind when you get the consult and you're going to go, you know, stalk the chart, ask the patient the questions, ask the nurse how things have been going? What sorts of things are you looking out for that are going to make your job more challenging or that have made the situation as challenging as it is?
Sure. So, you know, when I'm thinking about risk factors, I'm thinking about how those risk factors are going to affect my decision making. And so to be able to do that, I need to think about what my options are reconstructively, because that's going to then affect how I think about those risk factors. So I'm going to jump ahead to thinking about what the reconstructive options
are. Please do.
Reconstructive options, you know, are things from intra-abdominal or from the abdominal region, versus things from thigh-based flaps for reconstruction. And those are kind of two of the major areas, right? So one could think of like a VRAM or omentum versus like a gracilis or like a gluteal flap or posterior thigh flap. And so now with that framework in mind, the things that I want to know about, has the patient had multiple abdominal surgeries? Have they already had abdominal radiation? Those things may affect the ability of the omentum to be used, right? Has the patient had multiple incisions? Do they have, a urostomy as well as a colostomy, right? So is there a rectus that's even available for a VRAM flap? So that's another more comorbidity or kind of patient factor that I'm thinking about. When I'm thinking about, in general, the need to do any type of reconstruction, I'm wondering if the patient has radiation, a history of radiation, because then that's going to tell me on face whether I need to actually do any type of flap or whether I should just be thinking about potentially taking the patient back, doing a local washout, and then maybe doing a layered closure again over some drains. And then, you know, there are other risk factors like obesity and smoking, and those are important risk factors, and nutrition as well that we think about. But smoking and obesity, I can't really intervene on. Those are the same things that are going to lead to a higher risk of the APR defect opening in general. And at the same time, you know, I know if I make any incision anywhere else on that patient, if they're a smoker, they have a higher risk of breaking down. But does it preclude me from doing that operation? Not necessarily at that point. I think at that point, your hand's kind of, you know, drawn on that. So those are kind of the things I think about. From a nutritional perspective, optimizing nutrition is critically important. At some point, you get involved maybe afterwards. And so then it's just being very aggressive postoperatively with nutrition.
I just want to dive into one of those risk factors. Many of these colorectal patients will have had radiation, whether it's for an anal tumor or a rectal tumor or something like that. How exactly, you kind of led into it a little bit, but how exactly does radiation to that field impact your choice of flap or if that's, or local wound care and things like that?
Sure. So, you know, I mean, how radiation affects tissue and tissue healing is kind of we know that it does. The mechanism underlying it is varied, right? And it affects tissue quality from the perspective of vasculature, as well as tissue stiffness and fibrosis, which necessarily affects the way that that cells are actually able to grow more, release more collagen, and allow the bridging process to occur. Ultimately, when I think about radiation, I'm thinking about getting out of the field of radiation and bringing in healthy soft tissue that hasn't been radiated for multiple reasons. One is my preference is not to make another incision in a radiated site because it would potentially lead to the same type of wound that the patient is going to have with their APR defect that's been radiated. And secondly, getting healthy soft tissue that's not been radiated has a higher likelihood of potentially bringing in nice vascularized tissue that can at least try to heal into that surrounding radiated tissue. So getting out of the field of radiation is what's important to me. And defining that field of radiation is based on observation and based on kind of seeing what has the radiation done to the surrounding tissues.
So in a patient where all the options are available, which option do you find yourself using the most, or what do you think is there a most desirable option if it's available?
Yeah, I think if the skin is intact, if you have skin there that from the APR defect that can provide closure kind of superficially, then I think a gracilis is a nice option. And I think, you know, either unilateral or bilateral gracilis are nice options to bring in healthy vascularized tissue that can then basically fill in the subcutaneous space immediately deep to your cutaneous closure. I think that if you're missing skin, then, you know, it changes a bit, obviously, and you're thinking more about potentially a VRAM as an option to bring in skin as well as rectus muscle. But I think the gracilis is a great flap. I don't think it's as reliable for skin. So you can get a skin paddle off the gracilis, for example, distally. But I don't think that skin paddle is as reliable, and most people don't think it's that reliable. And the last thing you want to do is put a patient through a big operation and then have, you know, an unreliable skin paddle where you need it. So that kind of defines kind of my breakdown.
Can you walk us through very briefly the steps of your gracilis flap?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So for the gracilis flap, you know, positioning is everything, and patient positioning. If you can have the patient in lithotomy, that's ideal. And then, you know, drawing that line basically from the pubic symphysis to the medial knee, medial patella, kind of gives you an axis for the gracilis flap. And oftentimes, you know, the things to remember about the gracilis are that it's fairly superficial. And it falls back posteriorly. So it's posterior to that axis and it's fairly superficial. So you make that incision, you basically try to make an incision about 1 to 2 centimeters posterior to that axis that I just described. And one should encounter the gracilis fairly quickly through the subcutaneous tissue. And it tends to be a fairly isolated muscle in the sense that you know, you're looking at the fiber directionality, you should be able to get around it very easily. And if it's coalescing with other muscles in the thigh region, then most likely it's not gracilis. And then it could be, you know, one of your medial adductors. So you really want to be cautious with that because that's going to be an opportunity to create injury if you're not around the gracilis itself. And then, you know, you basically are dissecting down distally, transect it, and then flip it proximally. The other option is so instead of making a complete incision along that axis, you can also just make your incision distally along the medial knee, find your insertion of the gracilis, and transect it, and then just subcutaneously dissect it without making a long incision. The way that I've always done is make the long medial incision and actually just visualize the whole thing, because it is easy to get into the wrong point.
One of the other options I was just curious to hear your thoughts on, and vascular, we use omental flaps a lot
yes.
to cover grafts and different things. Can you just tell me sure. a little bit any tips from the plastic surgeons on how to best use an omental flap successfully?
Yeah, so the omentum is a great option for patients who haven't had multiple, obviously, intra-abdominal operations and haven't had intra-abdominal radiation. So it really depends on what the patient's previous history is. And I think that's kind of first and foremost. The omentum, if they haven't had a previous operation, then it's a fairly nice, big, you know, piece of soft tissue that you just release and let it drop down. I think that in those situations, you know, in plastic surgery now, we primarily are coming through, a lot of us come through an integrated pathway. And so we have a little bit less experience with the omental flap through our training. And I think that collaborating with the general surgery team to isolate the omentum off the gastroepiploic vessel, off the right up gastroepiploic is important. And so, and then, you know, transecting and ligating your gastric vessels as they come off and making sure that you're not causing ischemia to the stomach as well, which is a feared complication of that flap. But I think in that situation, you know, collaborating with the general surgery team is critically important. Making sure it's a virgin abdomen is important as well. And then that soft tissue will just fall right down, which is nice. But I think it's a great option, again, if you're not looking for skin.
So one last question on this topic before we move on. Sacral pressure ulcers, as you mentioned earlier, are not really perineal wounds, but they are in that general location, and some of the reconstructive options and mindset are similar. How does your approach to these wounds compare and contrast to the approach to the perineal wounds that we have been discussing?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that for the sacral pressure defect or any pressure ulcer, it's really critically important to optimize the patient from a social perspective and from a nutrition perspective. Those are things that one has a lot of time to do, right? So whereas APR is for tumor, a sacral pressure sore, this patient may have had for a very long time. And so we have time to optimize their nutrition, optimize their social situation so they're getting their turns appropriately, so they have appropriate care at home, making sure the patient is optimized after reconstruction so that they aren't going to be in a position where we've performed a major reconstruction and then they're lying supine on that reconstructed site for a prolonged period of time, right? So those are all things that are very important, you know, smoking history. So whereas a patient with an APR defect, you know, if they're a smoker, they're a smoker. That's what it is. But with a patient who has a pressure sore, you know, stopping smoking and nicotine use altogether, we have, I guess one could say, we have the luxury of time to try to get that to stop before we move forward with any type of reconstruction. So I think that's what it's all about, is the difference in the sense of urgency. And that's not to say it's not important to be able to reconstruct these. It very much is. But it's the onus is on us then to optimize that patient before putting them down that path. The flaps are pretty much similar. I mean, obviously, omentum, not really an option. Gracilis is probably not an option to get all the way back there to the sacrum, as opposed to like a gluteal rotation flap or a VY advancement flap, things like that.
Awesome. Awesome. And we have a lot of medical students and interns who listen to the podcast. So because it'll always come up on a test, just trying to remind myself the most common areas specifically for a pressure injury back there come from the ischial, the ischial tuberosity, the trochanters and the sacrum. Is that right?
Yeah. So let me ask you, Michael, what positioning has the highest likelihood of causing a sacral pressure ulcer?
Would that be like seated in lying down versus seated would be the ischial tuberosities. Yeah,
exactly. So supine is sacral. The trochanter from side to side, obviously, heals from having a patient who's too tall for their bed and they have the bedposts and the landing at the end of the bed and their heels are just resting on that, and they can develop pressure sores there as well. From a reconstructive perspective, you know, always thinking about making sure that you're not going to lead to another pressure sore in the patient you've reconstructed. So if you are doing an ischial pressure sore reconstruction, making sure that, you know, offloading, even regardless of where it is, but making sure that when they're offloading, that they're not going to create a pressure sore where you're offloading onto, right? Mm-hmm. So those patients have now one less positioning that's available to them. And so, I've had patients who we've done like a sacral pressure sore and now they never lay prone and now they have to lay prone. So talking to them about that beforehand is important because otherwise, they'll get a lot of pushback from the patient because, you know, they've never laid prone before in a long time and it's not something you can tolerate. So those are all things to think about.
All right, listeners, that was the first half of our recording with Dr. Agarwal. Sorry for the abrupt stop, but we just had too good a time talking with him, and this episode was getting a little long. I had to split it in two. So stick around for next week's part two of this episode, where we continue discussing reconstruction of the trunk. You'll definitely want to hear Dr. Agarwal's insights on reconstructing abdominal as well as chest wall defects. Until then, remember that we are currently requesting all surgical educators interested in joining us on the Behind the Knife team to go to our Twitter and Facebook and see the details for applying for one of those two-year positions on the podcast. And also, please tweet us if you have any further ideas for what plastic surgery topics you'd like our experts to cover, or any topics at all, really. But all right, see you all next week.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary. With Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.